Hey there, guys. This is Alex Lokes, and this is Classic Camera Revival for September 2015. That's right. We are going big, and we're not going home. This is the large format show. Don't worry. We're not going anything bigger than 4x5.
Coming to you from Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to this show.
Hey guys, welcome back, and today we're going to get away from roll film cameras that we've been talking about for the past episodes and go into sheet film. I'm still counting myself as relatively new to the format. I got my first one a couple years ago now. Still got a ways to go, so we have three fantastic cameras on the table today, plus a bunch of other discussions surrounding different types of optics you can apply to these cameras and how to develop sheet film at home when you don't have one of the lovely but very expensive Jobo processors. So we're going to turn it over first to Mike, and because he has the only monorail camera on the table, the Calumet CC400. Take it away, Mike.
Thanks, Alex. Okay, so the Calumet CC400 is a entry-level monorail, but that said, it still has all the movements you'd expect from a monorail. It's got front tilt, rear tilt, front rise, it's got shift, it's got shift both at the front and the back, and it's big, it's heavy, it's bulky, and it's fantastic for architecture and studio shots. That said, I have also taken that beast out onto out into the field, and I'm probably one of the few people that have actually shot the thing from a handheld position, which, believe me, it's not a good idea to do. It's really heavy, it's really tough to focus, and it's just not practical, but I wanted to see if I could do it. Now, the other thing about the monorail, at least my particular model, is 105, maybe even 90 mil is about the absolute limit that you can collapse it to, unless you can get a recessed board. But even then, I don't believe it'll work out too well, because I'm almost positive that the rear element, even on a 90, is just sitting right in front of the focusing screen, and it's not quite enough distance if you're looking for movements, if you're looking for anything else other than just a straight horizontal shot. Unfortunately, it's not quite good enough for anything less than a 90. Now, that said, I know you can get bag bellows and stuff like that, but it's not going to make too much of a difference just because of the framing, the way it's designed. For something else like that, I'd more suggest something like a field camera.
Now, Mike, what made you choose a monorail camera over something a little more practical to use in the field, like a field camera or a press camera?
Well, the one thing that really sold me on the monorail for it was mostly the price. I was looking at getting into 4x5, and Donna just happened to come across a listing that she saw. The price was fantastic, was the camera. It included, I believe, four holders, plus the case, and we're looking, I can't remember exactly what she spent, but it was under 200, and it was local, so I could go out and pick it up, and it was a great Christmas gift. I mean, I was absolutely ecstatic. I've had this camera for about 3 years now, so I'm pretty new into large format. I'm starting to get a bit better at it, but comparing to some other people's work that I've seen, I've got a long way to go.
Okay, next up, we're taking a very radical shift away from the monorail camera, which does get its name by the fact that the front element and the rear element are mounted on a single rail, hence monorail. We're going to go with John, who has a wonderful speed graphic, which is a press camera, similar to the ones that you'd see in those old movies, where you'd see these people with lightsaber-like grip attachments with giant flash bulbs going, one more shot, one more shot. So take it away, John.
Thanks, Alex. Now, I do have to preface by saying my very first 4x5 was a monorail camera, similar to Mike's. It was a Cambo SC. It's sitting in a box in my basement, but it just never gets used. But I'm able to use the most of the lenses I have with the speed graphic. I really like this camera. I got it a couple of years ago, and for a long time it was sort of sat underutilized. The problem I had is when I got it, the rangefinder, because even though I'm talking about it today in the context of it being a view camera rather, they actually are rangefinder cameras, but they have to have what's called a cam that's properly calibrated, otherwise the rangefinder is inaccurate. You'll line it up in the rangefinder and you'll get a nice big blurry image. And even after trying to get someone to look at it, I did not get proper focusing, so it just sort of sat there. But then I got the brass Petzval lens that I described in a previous episode, in the DIY episode. So I'm not going to go too far into that. I suggest you go back and listen to that episode. Well, I suggest you listen to all the episodes if you haven't already. And that's when I started using this camera quite a bit. Again, the main advantage for brass lenses like that typically don't have shutters built in is that the speed graphic has a rear focal plane shutter, the biggest shutter you have ever seen. And so I can use brass lenses on this camera quite easily, and I'm very happy with the results. Now, having said that, I've also have two Kodak Ektar lenses for the camera, and the Ektar lenses were tended to be among the standard lenses for the speed graphic, and these Ektar lenses are beautiful. They're some of the best work that Kodak ever did. They're professional quality lenses, and I'd really recommend them. Now, we have to differentiate between what a press camera can do and a monorail or rail camera can do. The press camera, it will have some movements, typically more in the in the rise, that kind of thing, but it's not going to have a lot of swing. It'll have a little bit in the way of movement, but not hugely exaggerated the way you can with a monorail camera. So for certain kinds of shots where you need the extended movements, the press camera is really not the way to go. But I find for what I do, which most of the time is portrait work, it's not really an issue for me. One thing we probably should mention, if we're talking about speed graphics, if you're thinking of getting one, a couple things to look out for. First of all, this camera was in production for a long time, and there are some old ones out there, and I believe if you go way, way back, they use a different kind of 4x5 film holder, not the standard. Oh, help me out, Alex. Graflock. Thank you. The standard Graflock, made by Peerless, any number of brands. You get them online for eBay. Those 4x5 holders will fit just fine. But there were some earlier holders called, I think they were called just Graflex. And these ones now are not as common. They're an issue. I would recommend that unless you're a collector and know exactly what you're doing, stay away from the old holders and go with one of the newer models that takes the 4x5. Another difference between the typical use of a view camera, and in most cases, like the lenses on a view camera will have a built-in shutter. And so you'll screw a cable release into the shutter and shoot that way. As I said, the speed graphic has this big honking focal plane shutter at the back, and you have to crank it. You basically wind it up like a spring, and it is about the most cumbersome shutter tensioning mechanism I've ever seen. It is not friendly, and the one I have is actually one of the friendlier ones. Some of the older ones, you'd see numbers, and you had to look up to see. You'd be setting speed of the shutter and the width of the slit, and you would derive the shutter speed from that. A real pain in the butt. Plus, if you want to get to, let's say, a 250th on my camera, that is three cranks. And if you have a model posing and you're asking him or her to stay still, well, you crack the shutter three times and put the film holder in, that can take a little while. So I would have to say that that is one area where a leaf shutter in the view camera lens really is really preferable. But if you have a vintage lens like I do that has no shutter, I have seen auxiliary shutters. I have one, but doesn't quite fit my lens, which is sad. You can get these add-on shutters, but they are very, very uncommon now. And so they either don't work or they're extremely expensive. Like, I've seen people ask $200 for these add-on shutters. So using the back focal plane shutter, even with its cumbersome way of working, is still what works for me. So, and I'll just finish off by saying what I think is neat about the Speed Graphic is that it's two cameras in one. You can use it as a handheld range finder or viewfinder, like scale focus, if you're not quite convinced that the range finder is working, or you can use it as I do, as the view camera. Two very different experiences, one camera. I think that's a pretty good deal. And I found online these are very, very affordable cameras.
Now, speaking of the Speed Graphic, I remember back at the London Games, a gentleman named David Burnett, I believe was his name. Yeah, David Burnett, who used a Speed Graphic to capture some absolutely stunning images at the 2012 London Games.
Yes, absolutely. I remember seeing that. Someone posted it to my wall on Facebook.
And there's just something about the quality of a 4x5 negative that you just can't beat.
No, absolutely.
Well, you can if you go with a 4x5 positive.
Or 8x10.
Or 16x20 Polaroid.
Yes. Well, I happen to actually know someone who's a 20x24 shooter.
Yes.
But he said the film is like ridiculously and prohibitively expensive to the point where he basically just shoots paper negatives.
Yep. Yep.
And even then, it's not that cheap.
Yeah. Well, that's the one thing that large format is. It is definitely an investment in both equipment and in time and in weight you carry around with you.
Oh, yeah.
And so continuing on the line of press cameras, the camera that I'm going to talk about is the cousin of the Speed Graphic, known as the Crown Graphic. Now, the big thing that sets these two cameras apart is the fact that the Crown Graphic does not have the focal plane shutter like the Speed Graphic does. So it makes using the tube-style lenses a little more difficult. Now, I have used a PESVAL lens on a field camera to do some wet plate work. Well, shoot a wet plate and just use the cap of the lens sort of technique, but you can do that with wet plate as opposed to regular film. So the reason I went with a Crown Graphic is simply because I got it for an excellent price, and my poor Speed Graphic was dying a slow, painful death. It had the older Graphic style back, which simply was spring-loaded. This one had the nice, much more modern Graflock back. Another thing that's a problem with these is finding lens boards for them, because they use a proprietary metal one with a bit of a lip on it. So it's very hard for someone to manufacture them. And thankfully, I was able to find someone on eBay who did it. And like John mentioned before, I can use it both as a view camera by using the ground glass on the back, but I also have a functioning rangefinder on mine that's been calibrated. So I've actually gone out and shot it handheld, not to the same extent as my friend Sean Galbraith, who took his Crown Graphic into the middle of the G20 riots when that was happening in Toronto, and again caught some absolutely fabulous images with it. And another nice thing is that even though I had switched from going from a Speed Graphic to a Crown Graphic, is that I just got new lens boards and I could use all my lenses that I had acquired with my Speed Graphic and the film holders with my Crown Graphic. That's the one nice thing that a lot of modern roll film camera manufacturers never got a hold of, was being able to be universal. The only thing that really came close was the M39 and M42 mount lenses, but as soon as you got into bayonets, you started getting all these different camera manufacturers doing things. Whereas with large format, it was fairly standard right from the beginning, probably because it is the oldest format that's still in production today.
Well, speaking of your Crown Graphic, going back to another Olympics, the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics, photographer Guy Rhodes, he shot a Crown Graphic and using Tri-X.
There we go.
There's another thing to look out for.
Yes, absolutely. So, going on the topic of optics, Mike, you seem to have a bit of an obsession. Well, not a bit of an obsession, a big obsession with rapid rectilinear lenses. So, let's hear a bit about those.
Okay, so rapid rectilinear lenses, they're really, really basic lens designs. It's basically just a pair of elements. You've got one element in the front, and then you've got a second element in the back that's separated by a space of air, and that's usually where the leaf shutter sits. Now, the funny thing about those is you can actually, if I remember correct, I've done it a few times, is I take off one of the elements and it turns into a meniscus lens, but it also changes the focal length of the lens. So there's one thing that I really, really like about it, but they're also slow. So, I mean, when you look at, say, a Schneider Zenar that's f5.6, the fastest rapid rectilinear lens I've ever seen, I believe, is an f8. And that was really pushing it, because you don't want to be shooting it wide open, because you get really, really soft edges. You get a nice, fine, sharp center, but the edges are pretty soft. Now, even when you stop down these type of lenses, it does get sharp. And I mean, I've got a couple images that I'm definitely going to be sharing. They are just amazingly sharp. But when you watch out to the edges, you do see it is soft. Now, a lot of the RR lenses that I have been using, I've been pulling off of old Kodak folders. So now the really funny thing about that is when you look at these old Kodak folders, they're on 1/16 film. And 1/16 film is not as big as 4x5. I believe it's a 2.25 by 3.25, almost size negative.
Yeah.
And the really funny thing about that is I'm actually getting almost complete coverage on a 4x5 sheet of film. Now, I do get a little bit of fall off in the corners, and you get absolutely no movement whatsoever, because as soon as you move it, you start to get a lot of fall off. But the look, that is where I love these lenses, is the look. I've tried all sorts of different lenses. They're really, really sharp. But then when it comes to rapid rectilinear, I find the look that you get is, you just can't replicate it with any other type of lens. Now, of course, with a Petzval lens, where you get the amazing out-of-focus area, on an RR lens, you don't get that swirl. You get sort of like a hazy, kind of dreamy, out-of-focus area. But I don't know how really good they'll be for portraits, but I know as far as going with landscapes, I've really, really enjoyed using them for landscapes or for still life shots. So if you're ever in the market for an RR lens, or you're wanting to look into them, or you want to get an inexpensive lens, that's the other kicker about them, is they're inexpensive, especially if you're just getting into 4x5. RR lenses are fantastic lenses to have, and you can really play around with them and not worry too much about them, because if something happens to it, well, they're not a lot of money and you won't feel too bad. But if you had, say, a Tesser lens, or you had a Nikkor or a Fujinon, and something happened to those, you kind of start to cry a little bit, especially as you see those prices getting up there and up there and up there. And yeah, the faster absolutely. The lens, yeah, the faster the lens, the more pricey it gets. And, well, RR lenses, they're nice and slow, and they're nice and cheap.
One thing I want to throw in here is if you are interested in using historic and antique lenses in a view camera, I'm going to recommend an ebook that I picked up a while ago, and I'll make sure that we have the link to it in the show notes. The ebook is called The Use of Historic Lenses in Contemporary Photography. The author is a guy named Paul Lipscomb, and it's available on lulu.com, and this book is like, it's the textbook. it goes through the history of all the various kinds of lenses. It gives tips on what they're good for. It shows a lot of examples of this guy's photography. He's not just a scholar. He's an excellent photographer in his own right. And because it's an ebook, it's dirt cheap. I would say that if you want to go and explore vintage lenses, this is almost a gotta have book.
Hmm. Nice. I'll have to go check it out.
Yeah, me myself definitely have to check it out. Just what we need. More reason to have gas.
Absolutely. Now, the one thing that is a bit of a struggle with 4x5, especially processing at home, is that not everyone has the $2,300 or more dollars to drop on a Jobo auto processor, which, well, a wonderful tool, does cost a lot of money. But thankfully, there are a few cheap alternatives out there. The one that I use is a Bessler print drum that's designed actually to do 8x10 prints, but it also has a center rail that I can slide in, and I can process two sheets of 4x5 at one time. I could do four if I had the proprietary holder in the middle, but I haven't managed to A, find one, or B, find a way to manufacture my own at home using material laying around the house. But it uses 300 milliliters of chemistry in one go, and it's a relatively fast way to do that, and I can just continue to do it in my kitchen in the daylight. The other two options, the first being the old-fashioned style tray processing, but again, you need a complete light-tight room. So you need to know where everything is. You can't even have a safe light on unless you're doing paper or orthochromatic films like Ilford ortho copy film or X-ray film, where you can actually have the safe light on. The second option, again, you're in the same restriction, as using hangers and tanks. But these days, hangers are a bit harder to find. I think they're the pile still at Burlington Camera. But again, you still have to find the tank. But again, those you can probably go and find a place. And it does use a lot more chemistry. There is another option, though, and that actually fits into your Patterson tanks. And I believe, John, you've had experience with the Mod 54?
Yeah. The Mod 54 is a guy in England who put together a special film holder that could hold, I believe, six sheets of 4x5 at once. I bought one, I tried it, and I sold it. Now, because we do a review show, it doesn't mean the reviews will always be positive. No. And this is one that did not work for me. I found it extremely difficult to load. It was very easy for sheets to pop out once you had them loaded. And there's nothing like rooting around on the floor trying to find a sheet of 4x5 film that's fallen in the darkroom. Don't like doing that. Yeah. And what I also found is when I managed to get the holder loaded is that you had to be very, very, very gentle with your agitation regimen. If you agitated like for a normal film reel, I found the sheets came off. And I had one portrait one time, one of my favorite portraits, the negative was scratched up to hell. It was hours and hours of Photoshop to clean up the scan, because the image was worth preserving. Maybe I'll put that one in the show notes, Alex, because it's a great portrait, but I can never print it wet print, right? Because it would take weeks and weeks of retouching the old fashioned way, and I'm not that good at retouching. So I sold the Mod 54. It might work for you. I'm not condemning it, but I did not have a happy experience with it.
The other method that I'll touch base a little bit on is the taco method. Oh. I've seen that one done many times. I've tried it. First time I tried it, I hated it. I mean, I used exactly what they suggested, a rubber band a hair elastic that really doesn't have much stretch, but is also pretty porous, so the chemical can seep into it so that it can develop the negative. Well, I tried it. I still had lines across the negatives. I did not like it one bit. The other method is one that I know John's been doing, and I wrote a blog post on it after I heard it from a friend on how he does it. He takes, and it's only maybe about 150, 200 mil of chemistry. You take a large stainless steel tank, or you can probably use a three-reel Patterson tank, or Paterson, however it's pronounced, and you put a single sheet of 4x5 film in, and you put it against the side of the tank with the emulsion facing to the center. You put the chemical in, you lay it on its side, and you roll it back and forth. And you since it's continuous agitation, you drop off about 10% of your developing time, and you just roll it back and forth, just constantly. And every time I have done it, I have gotten perfect negatives. No scratches, no marks, just beautiful negatives.
Yeah, and sounds like how I do things with the Bessler, except I have a base that actually does the rolling for me. So I can just lays back and surf the net while it takes care of business.
Exactly. Well, he usually does it in a, I believe he does it in a tub that has some water in, so he can just roll it and spin it in the water.
Yep.
I didn't get that elaborate. I went and just put it on the side of the table and just kind of roll it back and forth. And that's what I do.
That's
as far as I go.
One thing we should, I think, mention, if we're going to use the plastic, like a Patterson tank, I believe you still have to put the center plastic spindle in.
Because
that's part of what makes that tank light tight.
Yes.
With the stainless steel, which is what I use, you know, as long as you have the cover on,
you're
fine. And Mike's right; it's almost foolproof. It works very, very well. What I do, you know, I don't like wasting chemistry. So for four by five, I've actually been developing in stock solution. I've been using D76 stock, and as you process more sheets, you have to adjust the developing time, but it has, it's worked just fine for me.
Beautiful. Now, people out there are probably wondering, we're talking about all these old cameras and 4x5 and all that, and the question that a lot of us, especially us film shooters, get is, can you still get film for that? And the answer is actually, yes, you can. Aside from the big three, that being Kodak, Ilford, and Fuji, which all still produce 4x5 film and larger. In fact, both Kodak and Ilford offer odd sizes. Ilford does a yearly thing, and Kodak works through Keith Canham. There are plenty of other producers out there that still produce large format film, and a couple of them are actually, one of them is actually very, very new. There's, of course, Fomapan, which produces a wide range from 100 to 400, and they actually just released the RetroPan 320, which is one that I'm actually looking forward to trying. As soon as Freestyle gets it in stock, I'll put it in an order. Adox is still around. I just recently shot some of their CHS 102, which is their brand new emulsion that's available in 4x5 and is absolutely gorgeous. And the new one, the new player in the game, is the folks at New 55. Now, if you're an old shooter, you probably remember Polaroid Type 55 film, which produces not only a positive, but a usable negative that you can put into an enlarger. Polaroid, as everyone knows, has gone under, and while the fine folks at Impossible Project have brought back the Instant Integral film, the folks at New 55 are working at bringing back Type 55, and they actually have a wonderful product. And I've shot their single sheet Atomic X one shot film, but I actually recently just got a pack of their positive negative material, and there will be an example of that up in the show notes when I actually get around to shooting it. So yeah, large format, just like roll film, is still around and still readily available from Downtown Camera, Burlington Camera. You can order it online from the Film Photography Project, Freestyle, and B&H down in the U.S. And does Argentix sell large format?
Yes, they do. Sometimes they have stock issues.
Okay.
But they have 4x5, even have 5x7 and 8x10.
There you go.
And they also they have a couple of interesting things. Like they have one stock, which is the Arista, what are they called? Ortholitho 2, I think it's called.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a, it's an orthochromatic stock, so you can work with it under safe light. It's really a sort of a high contrast stock that you have to sort of find a way to get a continuous tone from when you develop. It's dirt cheap. It's very, very inexpensive.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a package myself. I haven't got around to playing with it yet, but it is definitely in my plans.
I just popped onto the Argentix website here. I'm just looking at their 4x5 films. I'm seeing ADOX CHS 100, Arista EDU Ultra 100, the Arista Ortho Litho film, as John was mentioning, and it's ridiculously cheap for 50 sheets.
I mean, what's the price?
We're talking $18.
For 50?
For 50.
And that's $18 Canadian, folks. So for you people in the States, about 50 cents.
Bingo.
Exactly. The next thing I see on the list is the wonderful Rollei Black and White Infrared 400S. And that I've shot in 120. I've got a box of 4x5. I was really looking forward to shooting this year, but just never got around to it. And lastly, of course, is the Rollei Ortho 25.
Yes. Yes. Nice. And just so that everyone knows, that Rollei stock is actually old Agfa stock. Agfa still produces films. They just market it under different names for different distributors.
Oh, beautiful. It looks like Argentix also carries 5x7 film, which is fantastic for me, as I'm planning on getting my wonderful grandfather's Derador 5x7 field camera eventually restored and up and running. And, of course, they also do sell, as John was mentioning, 8x10. Their 8x10 film is by Arista. And they actually have, wow, they've got quite the list. Arista EDU Ultra 200, Ultra 400, and then they have the Ortholitho films.
Awesome. So, yeah, large format. Definitely worth checking out if you want to try something new, something to help really slow you down and to get absolutely incredible quality. And if you're a bit turned off by using vintage cameras, you can always check out on the cheaper side of things. There's the Intrepid Camera Company out of the UK. They just did a successful Kickstarter campaign and have a good production line going of hand-built plywood CNC precision machined field cameras. Or if you have a bit deeper pockets, you can look at Shenhao, which is out of China, and they produce absolutely gorgeous cameras as well. Again, field cameras and the such like. But as always, go used and make sure that the bells are tight and that everything looks good, and you'll have a fine working camera no matter how old it is. I've used a 1916 Kodak Pony Primo 2, actually, in Rochester, New York, with Tri-X film. So yeah, plenty of options. Now, before we end this episode, we actually have a wonderful listener letter that came to us from our good friend Sean Nelson down in the United States. Just wanted to give you a note of appreciation for your last solo podcast. That would be the July episode that I recorded in France. I'm taking a trip with a friend in September up to Wyoming for several days. We're packing developing gear with us to work on our downtime. I think even of going to pack my laptop and scanners. Anyways, thanks for the chip. Cheers. Well, Sean, thank you very much for your feedback and for the wonderful note. And good luck in your trip. And finally, there are a few events coming up in the Toronto area that are definitely worth checking out. On the 26th of September, Fujifilm and 500PX are actually hosting worldwide photo walks, mostly for their digital system, but you know what? Bring film. And of course, on the 17th of October, which also is World Toy Camera Day, 18th is the Photographic Historical Society of Canada's Big One sale. We'll make sure that there's a link to their poster on our episode notes. And that's taking place in Etobicoke. And it's always a good time and a great place to look for deals, especially on large format gear, if that's your thing. And of course, on the 17th of October is World Toy Camera Day. And I think that's about it for this episode. In this case, keep the shutters firing.
Keep those film holders flying.
Wow. I don't even know what to say to that.
Just play with your bellows.
There we go.
I'll just lube my monorail.
There we go.
You'll lube your monorail. Oh, God. Okay, that's one of your classic lines.
Cheers.
There we go.